So last week we finished chapter 7, that disposed of Haman. So a couple of things before we move on. As we said last time, Haman just sort of came out of nowhere. He was not listed in the big, long party as an advisor or nothing. He just sort of showed up out of nowhere. My speculation is that the reason he got picked is because when the two eunuchs plotted to wipe out the king, he freaked and he became paranoid and had no idea who he could trust. These were people who were in his court, presumably people that he'd known for a long time, and the fact that they were the ones who were the ringleaders trying to take him out made him, I think, suspicious of the entire court. So Haman shows up out of nowhere, and the way he sets things up is Haman became essentially the filter between the king and the world, if you will. We saw that in the case where Esther said to her cousin, the king hasn't asked for me in a month, and the law is if I go in there and he doesn't acknowledge me, then there's one law, and that's death on the spot. As I said at the time, as a practical matter, I don't think she was any great danger. Having gone through the business of disposing of one queen, I don't think he wanted to do that again. And so the idea is, you know, she knows the rules, and the fact that she shows up unbidden, he's her husband. He obviously would immediately, there's something serious going on here. She's not coming in here to poison my biscuits or to show off a new dress or anything frivolous. She's here because there's something serious going on. So the actual danger that he will not acknowledge her is really very minimal. A couple of interesting things, though. Haman has become the filter between him and his kingdom, and between him and everybody else. So when we have the dinner party and Esther outs Haman, and Haman at that point realizes he's been mousetrapped and panics and tries to plead for his life, one of the things that Yoram Hazoni says is when the king comes back and finds him sprawled across the queen's couch, his suspicion is that there has been an affair. In other words, she asks the king and this guy to a private dinner, and he's sort of suspicious of Haman anyway, because Haman's got delusions of grandeur and so forth. The other is that he may have suspected that Haman was trying to get rid of the witness. What it says is obviously he was in a panic and was pleading for his life, which I think is what the situation is. The only question is, how does the king read it? The other thing that is interesting is when the king comes in, sees Haman sprawled across his wife's couch, and is enraged. Chapter 7, verse 8. And the king returned from the palace garden to the place where they were drinking wine, as Haman was falling on the couch where Esther was. And the king said, will he even assault the queen in my presence in my own house? As the word left the mouth of the king, they covered Haman's face. Then Harbona, one of the eunuchs in attendance to the king, said, moreover, the gallows that Haman has prepared for Mordecai, whose word saved the king, is standing at Haman's house 50 cubits high. Now, when Haman prepares this gallows, what is going on is clearly scuttlebutt in the court, because Harbona knows about this thing and knows what its purpose was. Harbona is one of the staff there, if you will. I don't know whether he's serving drinks at the banquet or what, but he's in there. And the point is, he knows what this gallows is and what its purpose was. The king clearly does not know that. So it goes back to the way the king has set himself up, where he's isolated from everything that's going on. And the scuttlebutt in the court is Haman is about to take Mordecai out. King doesn't have any idea that that's what's going on. And of course, the other part of that is that Mordecai is the one who saved his life. So the fact that Haman is trying to kill the man who saved his life, in addition to which he's trying to kill the queen's people, obviously has annoyed the king big time. The comment was in the Apocrypha on Esther, the reason that Haman wants to get rid of Mordecai is because Mordecai broke up the plot against the king, and perhaps Haman was sympathetic to that plot. And one of the reasons that he's after Mordecai is because he messed up something that Haman was trying to do. Again, that's apocryphal. I don't know the answer, obviously. It's another perspective. And as I say, the thing about Haman that is so weird is he just shows up out of nowhere. All we know about him is he's an Agagite, which is to say he's an Ammonite. And they are the historical enemies of the Jews starting from the Exodus. Remember, they are the ones that attacked the Jews in the wilderness during the Exodus. And Saul basically wiped them out. And that would have been something that they knew and Haman would have known. Just like Jews know their history, I'm sure the Agagites know their history. And so the fact that Mordecai identifies himself as a Jew and defies Haman, between those two things is plenty. Now, having said all that, let's get on to chapter 8. On that day, King Ahasuerus gave to Queen Esther the house of Haman, the enemy of the Jews, and Mordecai came before the king, for Esther had told what he was to her. So this is the first point. Esther has announced she's a Jew, and after Haman is out of the way, she also then tells the king about the fact that Mordecai, the guy who saved him, is her cousin. And so the king, at that point, remember having honored Mordecai to begin with for what he had done, you know, the public service he had rendered, now brings Mordecai in before himself. I'm not sure what the king's attitude is, other than he has lost his chief of staff, who is the gatekeeper between himself and the court, and in fact, the world. So Mordecai is not a known commodity, but Mordecai is certainly someone who has been recorded as standing up for the king and making sure that the king survives. So that's a big plus, if you will. Don't know anything about this guy. Don't know that he's smart. Don't know that he's dumb. Don't know anything. But we do know that he's the guy that broke up the plot to kill me. So at least that speaks to his character. And he's my wife's cousin. Verse 2. And the king took off his signet ring, which he had taken from Haman, and gave it to Mordecai. And Esther set Mordecai over the house of Haman. So Haman's house has been confiscated when Haman was killed, been given over to Esther. Esther then installs her cousin there, and I'm assuming that the reason for that is it's probably very convenient to the palace. Mordecai's got a place of his own. Don't really know where it is, but he is certainly able to come and go in the court. So I'm assuming Haman's place is better than Mordecai's. And given that Haman was in a position to bribe the king with 10,000 talents of silver in order to take out the Jews, the idea that he would have a very opulent house is pretty obvious. The other part of that, of course, is as chief of staff now, Mordecai needs to be close in. Verse 3. Then Esther spoke again to the king. She fell at his feet and wept and pleaded with him to avert the evil plan of Haman the Agagite and the plot that he had devised against the Jews. When the king held out the golden scepter to Esther, Esther rose and stood before the king. So time has passed. You have, this is who Mordecai is. Mordecai gets elevated to the chief of staff, and nothing happens for some period of time. So Esther comes back in after some period of time, and again, bows down before the king, and he extends the golden scepter to her. This is not all the same event where Mordecai is elevated to chief of staff, and then Esther turns around and talks to the king. There's a time lapse here. The thing about the time lapse is the king's decree is still in force. One of the big setups of the story is once the king issues an edict, it cannot be altered or changed in any way. So that edict that he made at Haman's behest is still out there. And Esther looking around and saying, okay, so what are we going to do about this? And at that point, she then comes into the king and makes a plea for her people. So verse 5 again. Esther rose and stood before the king, and she said, if it please the king, and if I have found favor in his sight, and if the thing seems right before the king, and I am pleasing in his eyes, let an order be written to revoke the letters devised by Haman the Agagite, the son of Hammedatha, which he wrote to destroy the Jews who are all in the province of the king. For how can I bear to see the calamity that is coming to my people? Or how can I bear to see the destruction of my kindred? So the elimination of Haman didn't move the king to do anything else except get rid of this guy who he had come to distrust, obviously. But other than that, he's not doing anything. The request to revoke the letters is a non-starter, because once they have been signed and sent, they are part of the law of the Medes and the Persians, which cannot be changed. One of the things that he does not say, which I find fascinating, is he doesn't say that. This is my speculation. It's sort of like he's now about half terrified of her, because he has seen that she was able to take out his chief of staff with absolutely no warning and nobody saw it coming. What do I do if she decides to take me out? And I would suggest it's probably a serious thought in his mind. So he doesn't say to her, oh, sorry, no can do, babe. Once the letters have been written, they're written, and there's nothing that can be done about it. Verse 7. Then King Ahasuerus said to Queen Esther and to Mordecai the Jew, behold, I have given Esther the house of Haman, and they have hanged him on the gallows, because he intended to lay hands on the Jews. But you may write as you please with regard to the Jews in the name of the king and seal it with the king's ring. For an edict written in the name of the king and sealed with the king's ring cannot be revoked. What Mordecai cannot do is say, you know, those letters that went before, rip them up, they're no longer valid. And what he does instead is give out a new edict which doesn't contradict the first one. This is a very delicate, logical dance that he's doing. If he were to write, tear all those other letters up, then there would be problems because a whole bunch of people would question what he was doing. And you know, you sort of have the idea that these people have absolute power. They can do anything they want. That's not true. They have absolute power within a system that they're part of. And if they step outside of the system, then typically all hell breaks loose. So they're very careful to stay within the confines of the system that raised them to a position of power. They don't want to destroy that system because it's their source of power. So they're very careful with it. 9. The king's scribes were summoned at that time in the third month, that is the month of Sivan, on the 23rd day, and an edict was written according to all that Mordecai commanded concerning the Jews, to the satraps and the governors and the officials of the provinces from India to Ethiopia. 127 provinces, to each province in its own script, and to each people in its own language, and also to the Jews in their script and their language. And he wrote in the name of King Ahasuerus and sealed it with the king's signet ring. Then he sent the letters by mounted courier riding on swift horses that were used in the king's service, bred from the royal stud. So the king obviously has got the best horses in all of Persia, and they are kept for his couriers. 11, saying that the king allowed the Jews who were in every city to gather together and defend their lives, to destroy, to kill, and to annihilate any armed force of any people or province that might attack them, children and women included, and to plunder their goods. On one day throughout all the provinces of the king, Ahasuerus, on the 13th day of the 12th month, which is the month of Adar, a copy of which was written and was issued as a decree in every province, being publicly displayed to all peoples, and the Jews were to be ready on that day to take vengeance on their enemies. So what he's done here is he has not nullified the edict, which says you're perfectly free to attack the Jews and plunder their stuff. That still stands. What he's said now, however, is to the Jews, you get to defend yourself. Now, why is that important? I mean, one assumes that when somebody attacks you, you would fight and defend yourself. The reason it's important is because of the governments of all of the provinces. If the first edict stands by itself, the governments of all the provinces are going to be on the side and helping those who are trying to kill the Jews. Yeah, you Jews may take out a knife and try and defend yourself, but not only are your enemies coming after you, but the government is too, because the edict is you're supposed to be destroyed. Now, by this second edict, they are now able to defend themselves, which is, I'm suggesting, they were going to do anyway. But now the government is taken out of the equation. And instead of the government helping those who are trying to take out the Jews, the government is at worst neutral. And we'll see that that's going to get even better. But the effect of the edict is government, you know, I'm not going to arrest all those people who are trying to kill Jews because they're allowed. It's okay. So I'm not going to arrest them for murder or anything like that, but I'm not going to help them. And if the Jews fight back, I'm not going to arrest the Jews for murder or anything like that. Okay? So in other words, the government is neutral in this case. The comment was, and it sounds like a declaration of civil war, and the king approves, and you're correct, in a sense. But remember, the Jews are a very small minority. They aren't a lot of people. And the edict has already gone out to kill them, and now it simply says they get to fight back. And government, you stay out of it. So it isn't the case that it's going to be a big civil war. It's going to be a skirmish, if you will. And the number of people that actually get killed in this process are only 75,000. I mean, that's hardly a decent-sized battle in biblical terms. So civil war, technically, you're correct, but in effect, it's not a big deal. 13. A copy of what was written was to be issued as a decree in every province, being publicly displayed to all peoples, and the Jews were to be ready on that day to take vengeance on their enemies. So the couriers, mounted on their swift horses that were used in the king's service, rode out hurriedly, urged by the king's command. And the decree was issued in Susa, the citadel. Verse 15. Then Mordecai went out from the presence of the king in royal robes of blue and white with a great golden crown and a robe of fine linen and purple. And the city of Susa shouted and rejoiced. The Jews had light and gladness and joy and honor. In every province and every city, wherever the king's command and his edict reached, there was gladness and joy among the Jews, a feast and a holiday. And many from the peoples of the country declared themselves Jews, for the fear of the Jews had fallen on them. Remember, this whole thing started when the king asked, all right, how do I honor somebody that's done me a good turn? And Haman said, whoa, me, of course, and asked to be arrayed in a royal robe with a crown on his head and riding on a king's horse and led through the city. In other words, I want to look like the king. Well, now Mordecai does the same thing. What Mordecai is doing is what I would describe as a little bit of trash talk. He is going out and he is showing himself as being the king's chief of staff, so greatly favored by the king that the king is willing to let him flounce around in his own royal garments. This guy is powerful. This guy is well positioned. The last thing we want to do is mess with this guy's people. Because if we take his people out, he is going to come after us, and he has got the position and the government behind him. So this whole display is intended to intimidate those who would be inclined, you know, well, there's only 50 Jews in the city and there's 200 of us and we get to take them out and steal their stuff. All of a sudden that calculus changes drastically, because if we do that, Mordecai is not going to be happy. And Mordecai not only has the king's ear as chief of staff, Mordecai is so much in favor of the king that he can pretty much flounce around in the king's robe and on the king's horse, and nobody messes with him. Comment was, this is the second time that's happened. The first time, however, it was done by Haman at the king's request. Now he is in the ascendance, if you will. All of this is political posturing, if you will, and intimidation of the enemies of the Jews. Now, as is the case here, there are still going to be people who are going to try to take out the Jews, because they do have that original edict. I can imagine in a town somewhere, all right, there's only 50 Jews and there's a couple hundred of us. You know, we got this edict and nobody's going to arrest us or anything, so let's go ahead and take these guys out and steal their stuff, which is the whole idea. Now, in the 12th month, which was the month of Adar, on the 13th day of the same, when the king's command and edict were about to be carried out, on that very day, when the enemies of the Jews hoped to gain the mastery over them, the reverse occurred. The Jews gained mastery over those who hated them. The idea is, how do you know who these people are who hate you unless they are doing something in service of that hatred? I am assuming here that when the day arrived, they thought that they could win, and obviously they don't. Verse 2, the Jews gathered in their cities throughout all the provinces of the king Ahasuerus to lay hands on those who sought their harm, and no one could stand against them, for the fear of them had fallen on all peoples. And the officials of the provinces and the satraps and the governors and the royal agents who also helped the Jews, for the fear of Mordecai, had fallen on them. So that second edict that Mordecai signs does two things. One, it takes government out of the equation. And then Mordecai, by showing himself as powerful as he is, the bureaucratic mind is, quite frankly, not very brave. Bureaucrats don't get where they are by being bold. They get where they are by being timid and following the rules and staying out of trouble. So the word on the street, the way the wind is blowing, however you want to describe it, is don't mess with Mordecai's people. So whenever there is an uprising and a battle goes on, the bureaucratically smart thing to do is to come down on the side of the Jews. For Mordecai was great in the king's house, and his fame spread throughout all the provinces, for the man Mordecai grew more and more powerful. The Jews struck all their enemies with a sword, killing and destroying them, and did as they pleased to those who hated them. In Susa, the citadel itself, the Jews killed and destroyed 500 men, and also killed Parshandatha and Dalthon and Ashpatha and Paratha and Adaliah and Ardatha and Parmashta and Arisi and Ardi and Vizatha, the 10 sons of Haman, the son of Hammedatha, the enemy of the Jews, but they laid no hand on the plunder. Remember, part of this, these edicts, is not only do you get to kill them, but you can take their stuff. And one of the things that you'll see here is the Jews, in fact, defend themselves, but they don't loot. I am suggesting that that is probably a good strategic move, because the canard that happens with Jews everywhere is they're greedy for money. And so the idea then that they get to defend themselves, and oh, by the way, we get to take all the spoil, would simply feed into that canard. So they don't touch the plunder. Verse 11. On that very day, the number of those killed in Susa the citadel was reported to the king. And the king said to Queen Esther, in Susa the citadel, the Jews have killed and destroyed 500 men, also the 10 sons of Haman. What then have they done in the rest of the king's provinces? Now, what is your wish? It shall be granted you. And what further is your request? It shall be fulfilled. The king is no dummy, and Kay has said many times her impression of him is he's not a very strong man. And the fact that he crawls into a hole when somebody tries to assassinate him is also indicative. So the last thing that he wants is an unhappy Esther, like a loose cannon around the place, because there's no telling what she'll do. Verse 13. And Esther said, if it please the king, let the Jews who are in Susa be allowed tomorrow also to do according to this day's edict, and let 10 sons of Haman be hanged on the gallows. Now, the sons of Haman are dead. What they're doing is stringing up their bodies. Because remember, this gallows is 50 cubits high, 75 feet, so you can probably see it from anywhere in the city. Haman's sons are already dead. They died the first day. So what we're doing now is we are displaying the bodies to the entire capital to make sure everybody gets the point. That's what's going on here. 14. So the king commanded this to be done. A decree was issued in Susa, and the 10 sons of Haman were hanged. The Jews who were in Susa gathered together on the 14th day of the month of Adar, and they killed 300 men in Susa, but they laid no hands on the plunder. So we've taken out 800 folks in Susa. Now the rest of the Jews who were in the king's provinces also gathered to defend their lives, and they got relief from their enemies and killed 75,000 of those who hated them, but they laid no hands on the plunder. This was on the 13th day of the month of Adar, and on the 14th day they rested and made that a day of feasting and gladness. But the Jews who were in Susa gathered on the 13th day and on the 14th and rested on the 15th day, making that a day of feasting and gladness. Therefore, the Jews of the villages who live in the rural towns hold the 14th day of the month of Adar as a day for gladness and feasting, as a holiday, and as a day on which they send gifts of food to one another. So now we're all the way down to verse 20. And Mordecai recorded these things and sent letters to all the Jews who were in the provinces of King Ahasuerus, both near and far, obliging them to keep the 14th day of the month of Adar and also the 15th day of the same year by year, as the days on which the Jews got relief from their enemies, and as the month that had been turned for them from sorrow into gladness and from mourning into a holiday, that they should make them days of feasting and gladness, days for sending gifts of food to one another and gifts to the poor. So the Jews accepted what they had started to do and what Mordecai had written to them. For Haman the Agagite, the son of Hammedatha, the enemy of the Jews, had plotted against the Jews to destroy them, and had cast pur, that is, cast lots, to crush and to destroy them. But when it came before the king, he gave orders in writing that his evil plan that he had devised against the Jews should return upon his own head, and that he and his son should be hanged on the gallows. You know, Haman himself was hanged months ago, and his son's more fresh. And the king, I don't believe, had any animus against the Jews. He was simply taking the advice of his chief of staff, who was also going to cover the expenses for that. 26. Therefore, they called these days Purim, after the poor. Therefore, because of all that was written in this letter and what they had faced in this matter and what had happened to them, the Jews firmly obligated themselves and their offspring and all who joined them that without fail they would keep these 2 days according to what was written and at the time appointed every year, that these days should be remembered and kept throughout their every generation in every clan, province, and city, and that these days of Purim should never fall into disuse among the Jews, nor should the commemoration of these days cease among their descendants. Then Queen Esther, the daughter of Abihail, and Mordecai, the Jew, gave full written authority confirming this second letter about Purim. Letters were sent to all the Jews, to the 127 provinces of the kingdom of Ahasuerus, in words of peace and truth, that these days of Purim should be observed at their appointed seasons as Mordecai the Jew and Queen Esther obligated them, and as they had obligated themselves and their offspring with regard to their fast and their lamenting. The command of Queen Esther confirmed these practices of Purim. It was recorded in writing. But that's weird. You've got Mordecai, who's got the king's signet ring. This is the first time that I know of that a queen has done something in her own name. Typically, the king is the one who does it, or his chief of staff, whoever has his signet ring. The idea that Queen Esther is commanding things of her people is interesting. I don't know what to make of it, but it's unusual. Chapter 10. King Ahasuerus imposed tax on the land and on the coastlands of the sea, and all the acts of his power and might, and the full account of the high honor of Mordecai, to which the king advanced him, are they not written in the book of the Chronicles of the Kings of Media and Persia? For Mordecai the Jew was second in rank to King Ahasuerus, and he was great among the Jews and popular with the multitude of his brothers, for he sought the welfare of his people and spoke peace to all his people. There's something interesting there. The Jews right now in Israel are in the middle of a war. They've been attacked by Hamas. They are still fighting among themselves. You have demonstrations in the street. We want new elections. We want to drop everything and bring the hostages home now. The idea that Mordecai is great among the Jews and popular with the multitude of his brothers is in itself amazing. You know, I say, look at what's going on in Israel right now. They're in a major struggle that if they lose, they've got major trouble. They're fighting among themselves. They're trying to bring the government down. It's foolish. So the idea that everybody loves Mordecai, that's really unusual. So thus ends Esther. And as I said at the beginning, this is one of the four great tales, if you will, of Hebrews in exile. You have four different tribes represented in those four stories. So the first one, of course, is Joseph, who's in exile in Egypt. And Joseph, of the tribe of Joseph, rises to second in command, and he almost goes native. He is loyal to Pharaoh. He does everything to advance Pharaoh's interests. He does take care of his own people, but he turns around and turns the Egyptians into serfs by the end of the famine. So his loyalty is to Pharaoh. He's a very competent administrator. He's honest. He's moral. But he's a company man. When his people come down, he doesn't move in with them. He stays in the court. So he is, as I say, loyal, upstanding, etc. But he is the king's man. The next one, of course, is Moses. And Moses is a Levite. And as we see from other stories of the Levites, Levites have a temper. So if you want to get busted out of slavery, you want a Levite, because he is able to go head-to-head with Pharaoh and not intimidated by Pharaoh. He's sort of intimidated by his inability to speak, but Pharaoh doesn't bother him. And he winds up wrecking Egypt and taking everybody out. The next one, of course, is Daniel. And Daniel is Judah. Daniel has been told by Jeremiah, all right, you folks are going to be in exile for 70 years. Settle down, become good citizens, work hard for the good of the place where you are, because in the good and prosperity of the place where you are, you yourselves will prosper. But you're going to be there 70 years. So Daniel also rises to second in command of the empire. He is also a superb administrator, and he is also faithful to his God. I mean, that's how everything's set up. Joseph has got some conflicts about that. He's ultimately faithful, but he's got some serious conflicts and temptation, especially when we get to Potiphar's wife and so forth. Daniel, on the other hand, starts his career by an act of faithful service where he refuses to eat the king's goods, and that sort of sets up the story. Good administrator. If you're in exile, having Judah in charge is a good deal because he's very competent. And then, of course, the last one here is Mordecai. He's from the tribe of Benjamin. And if you go back to the prophecies that Moses made over the tribes, Benjamin is a ravenous wolf. Benjamin is also competent. He's also a good administrator. He's also lethal. He has no problem, if you will, taking out the opposition, which he and his cousin, who was also from Benjamin, do quite handily. So those are your four temperaments, if you will, in exile. Four great stories there. And as you read those stories, consider the temperament of each of the tribes as described by Jacob when he blesses his 12 sons on his deathbed, and Moses when he prophesies over the tribes at the end of Deuteronomy. Read those accounts of the four tribes, and you can see those traits play out in how each of them behaves in exile. One of the things is everybody comments in the book of Esther, God is never mentioned. And that's true, he's not. Other than Mordecai mentions him obliquely, saying to Esther, if you don't step up, somebody else will. We are not going to perish. And that's, again, a statement of faith. Shama